From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at the U.S. Supreme Court this week when the court released a massively important decision regarding public sector unions. In a 5-4 decision that was expected, the court took the rare step of overturning a previous Supreme Court decision. Now, the current case, the one decided this week, stems from Illinois, where a public employee named Mark Janis didn't want to pay his union dues. And the majority opinion from the court held that Janis was right. He shouldn't have to pay dues if he doesn't want to, because forcing someone to pay union dues is a violation of free speech. Janis didn't like the union's politics, and he thought that by being forced to pay dues, he was forced to support speech and advocacy that went against his beliefs. The union contended that they were negotiating on behalf of all their workers. And someone like Mark Janis can't just not pay dues at all while still benefiting from their negotiation, raising wages, improving benefits. And in 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that unions were right to hold that position. You don't see this changed very often, but that did change this week. Now, depending on what you read, the result could dramatically cut public union membership, or it could marginally impact membership while offering more freedoms for workers. Critics of the decision also contend that workers suffer lower wages and worse benefits when they're not served by a union, and they worry about the ripple effects of this case. Let's discuss the impact and our guests. Two guests in studio with us. Harry Bronson is a New York State Assemblyman. Nice to have you back here, Harry. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Evan.
And also with us is Carrie Andrews, NYSET Regional Staff Director. That's New York State United Teachers. Carrie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
On the line with us is Ken Girardin, who's a policy analyst with the Empire Center for Public Policy. Ken, thanks for taking the time for the program. Somewhere there's Ken. Hi, Ken. Try it again. Hello.
thanks for having me on, Evan.
Okay, very good. Well, let's just kind of start with this because there's a lot to kind of sort through, and it does get complex, and we will get pretty granular here because this matters. I want to start with sort of the broad look, though, and ask some of kind of the big overarching questions before we get into some of the details. And I'm going to start with Carrie Andrews, a NYSET Regional Staff Director. Just about everybody knew this was coming. It was going to be a 5-4 decision. I want to ask you if the decision is exactly what you expected, roughly what you expected, what the impact on public union membership is likely to be, and what you do about it.
Sure. Thanks, Evan. I think the decision is what we were expecting. This is what we've been preparing for quite a while now. There have been two other previous cases along similar lines that made it up through to the Supreme Court. And so this was just the last and most recent case with a very similar concept to it. So the case came out 5-4 with a conservative court. Really see this as a continuation of an effort by wealthy elites to erode the rights of workers and middle class in this country. So it's right on par with a lot of other attacks we see. So yes, the decision was exactly what we were expecting. I mean, the good news is that we were prepared and we are prepared for it. No one was surprised by what the court ruled. And so we had a lot of time to anticipate the case, learn from our colleagues in other parts of the country who already operate in this sort of system where there's no fair share provision, incorporate that learning, and then plan for the future. And so what we've been doing is getting ready to be successful, to maneuver in this new day, in this new world in public sector labor relations in New York, and working with a lot of our members and local leaders in NYSET, and I believe other public sector unions as well, to have really deep one-to-one conversations with our members to explain union value and ask them what they want to see from their union.
Okay, and just understanding what is about to change here, and again, part of why Assemblyman Bronson's here is going to talk about whether New York State's landscape is going to be different than maybe other states. But before we get there, what would be different for a public sector employee, a union member, before Janis and then post-Janis decision in terms of what is either automatic, what kind of provisions there are for union membership, and how that structure changes now?
Sure. So for 41 years, the law of the land was, at least in New York, where we were a fair share state, you can, in a public sector union, you can belong and you're a dues-paying member, or if you wanted to opt out, that was still your right, but if you opted out, you were charged what's called an agency fee or the fair share of your cost of representation. And that was because if you opt out, the union's still obligated to represent you 100% of the time, and you're still eligible for every single benefit in that collective bargaining agreement, which research says it provides you higher wages, better health care, access to pensions, and a lot more economic security than your peers do if they're not represented by a union. So you received all of those benefits, and as a result of being in a unionized workforce, and therefore you were expected to pay for them, pay your share for them. So that changed and ended Thursday morning at 10 o'clock. So the new landscape is there's no longer any such thing as an agency fee or a fair share that's charged to somebody who opts out of the union in the public sector. You can be a dues-paying member and opt into the union, or you can opt out, in which case you don't have to pay anything. And under this new scenario, if you opt out, the union is still required to represent you for most things, and you still receive the benefits of everything in the collective bargaining agreement, even though you no longer have to pay for it.
Okay, and I know I tried to distill the Janus case. I've tried to read what Mark Janus himself has said and others who supported his position have said. Do you think I represented it fairly enough that what he was arguing, and we'll talk a little bit as we go throughout this program about why free speech, some people said, wait, what does speech have to do with it? We'll talk about that. But his argument was, you know, he didn't want to have to even pay an agency fee. He didn't want to even pay any even sort of a partial due or at least a minimal due, even if he was going to be repped. And did I frame it fairly? Is that roughly the outline of the case as you see it?
That's my understanding of it. He felt it was compelled speech. The court agreed that it was a violation of his First Amendment rights to compel him to pay for something that he didn't necessarily believe.
Okay. And let me turn to Ken Girardin for your broad view of this case. I assume it went how you expected as well. Ken, what's your first take on it?
Well, I want to give folks a broader look at things first. When we talk about people paying their, you know, quote-unquote fair share for what's coming out of collective bargaining, they need to recognize that it's not, you know, the system isn't constructed in a way that lets people, you know, freeload on the backs of others. The reason we have a legal obligation on the unions to represent everyone in the bargaining unit at the workplace is because the unions asked for it. The unions have been asking for that for half a century in New York. They got it required in statute in 1989. And it's a huge benefit for them because it keeps their competitors from coming into the workplace and representing, you know, a smaller group of workers there and trying to muscle them out. So it shields them from big competition the way NYSIT had a big competitor in New York until 2006 when they merged with their NEA affiliate. But then it also protects the union from having the best employees go out and cut their own deals. You can imagine what would happen if suddenly in school districts, the best teachers or the teachers in really sought after specialties were suddenly given the power to bargain for themselves and to, you know, to seek higher pay or to seek their own special treatment. It would, you know, it would really upset the apple cart, and you'd have lots more teachers trying to do that. So the requirement that unions cover everyone isn't just something that benefits individual workers. It's something that benefits the unions themselves. So I wanted to, you know, clarify that. The big question in the Janus case was whether everything a union does is political in one form or another. And it really is. We have this cultural consensus that people shouldn't be forced to pay for a union's campaign contributions or their lobbying spending. But at the end of the day, whenever a union sits down across the table to negotiate on anything or file a grievance on anything, they're lobbying there too. It's the same thing. They're asking the employer to do something or give them something that's going to change the way government operates, or it's going to require them to raise taxes. It's going to do something that affects the public fisc 100% of the time, whether that's overt lobbying or campaign contributions or just, you know, turning on the lights in the morning and working on a contract negotiation. So the court was correct to recognize this. We talk about the court having had this precedent from 1977 in Abood, but it was a really lousy decision because the courts just carbon copied their rationale from the private sector, where, you know, where you aren't lobbying, you know, where the union isn't lobbying the government, to the public sector, where it's a completely different type of boss.
Yeah, and what Ken's talking about, the 1977 Abood case, it could probably be its own decision if you read Elena Kagan's dissent here. She had a scathing dissent because what Alito is essentially saying in his opinion is, I know it's rare for us to overturn a previous court decision, but it was a really bad decision, and it needs to be overturned. And it's bad in a lot of different ways. Kagan is saying, you just tossed stare decisis out the window, and we're in real trouble here because now the U.S. Supreme Court can simply basically legislate that you're setting precedent for the court to just mow down previous decisions that it doesn't like based on changes in ideology on the court. That's a whole separate discussion. It's not the first time a previous decision has been overturned. It's not all that common. And Alito's essentially saying this was a terrible decision in 1977. Ken, when you talk about negotiating on one's own behalf, which, you know, one of the common discussions that union members will have with people who are not in the union, people who are not in the union may say, look, don't you want to be able to negotiate your own salary and benefits? If you're an exceptional employee, you talk about exceptional teachers. Don't you want to negotiate on your own? I certainly understand that. But let me ask you, Ken, on the whole, let's not talk about just a standout employee or two. On the whole, do you accept Kerry's position that the research indicates that for an entire body of workers, unions, their negotiating efforts raise wages and benefits and are a net benefit for workers?
For the entire body? Absolutely. I mean, it's impossible to look at the extremely high property taxes and high cost of government in New York and point to anything but the Taylor Law. It's not something in our water. It's the way we have collective bargaining here in New York. Now, having said that, the averages go up. That doesn't mean it's great for everybody.
Of course.
Take a teacher who gets fired under or let go under last in, first out, which the teachers union defends to the bitter end. Their pay goes to zero. So that, you know, we're not going to count that in the average. But, you know, those folks don't benefit from being in a union when the union is putting their necks on the chopping block and preventing the public employers from looking at, you know, any other criteria in doing layoffs. So I absolutely agree about the average, but when you talk about whether it benefits everyone individually, it's absolutely not true.
Okay, let's listen to what the Assemblyman has to say about this. And as I turn it over to Harry Bronson for his take as a state lawmaker, let me go ahead and read a statement that we were given by the Business Council on this. Under this headline, Janus decision is a huge victory for employee freedom, but the impact in New York State is likely limited. So let me go ahead and read their statement, and I'll turn it over to the Assemblyman. The Business Council says, quote, today's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Janus v. AFSCME is a welcome victory for employee choice and freedom of speech. Unfortunately, for many New Yorkers directly affected by this issue, the impact of the decision will be limited due to a last-minute provision tucked into the recently adopted state budget. The provision significantly limits an employee's time frame and ability to opt out of dues deductions, all but eliminating the freedom given to employees in other states thanks to the Janus decision. It will be interesting to see if New York's attempt to circumvent employee choice will be challenged in court. In the meantime, it is unfortunate that New York lawmakers decided to put politics over their constituents' ability to freely express themselves, end quote. Assemblyman Bronson?
Well, first of all, let's take employee choice. All employees have a choice. It's interesting that those who support the 1% in our population and those who support those millionaires and billionaires and the corporate America and things of that nature always talk about employee at will and you have a choice. So if you get fired from a job, you can always go someplace else and find another job. Well, let's apply that same principle here. If you don't want to work for a public employer and you don't want to work for a unionized outfit, then don't. Go someplace else. Work someplace else. You can use that same logic here. I say that employee choice is a fallacy. It's a fallacy when you look at employment at will. It's a fallacy here. The reality is this, as Kerry indicated, that the workforce is higher paid for all workers. It's higher paid for women and minorities in particular, because of the benefit of collectively bargain. Collective bargaining is in place because there's an acknowledgement that employees, unless they're able to come together, have a difficult bargaining stance with an employer because the employer carries the cards most of the time in our economy. So I think there's a lot of benefits for collective bargaining. The second thing is regarding, the dissent, I think, did an amazing job of calling this out for what it is. This is not a freedom of speech, a First Amendment case. That's not what this is about. Look at who backed the case. It's the Koch brothers and others, the same people who have fought for right to work across the country, the same people who have fought against unions across the country so that they can pad their bottom line. And Justice Kagan called that out. I think she's correct. They ignored stare decisis in this decision, relying, ironically, on Justice Alito's other decisions where he would insert comments about the Abood case and then relied on those comments in this decision. So that's a real danger, especially in the current climate. Free rider, let's look at that. This is akin to telling people, you know what, here's an insurance policy. You pay a certain premium, and you get these benefits if you pay those premiums. And then all of a sudden you say, you don't have to pay the premiums anymore, but you're still going to get the benefits. So that encourages, first of all, the people like Janice, and he has a right. He doesn't believe in unions. And so it encourages those people not to pay the dues. Those who are ambivalent, whether they support unions or don't, it encourages them not to pay the fee. And indeed, those who like the unions, it encourages them not to pay the fee because they get the same benefits without doing that. So acknowledging that in the state budget last that we just passed, we put in a provision that did a couple of things. One, it allowed the procedure or the process by which employees would have to affirmatively say that they're willing to have dues taken out. We cleaned up that process here in New York State, but we did another thing. Under the duty of fair representation under the Taylor Act, we tightened it up. And we said that unless it's expressly stated in the collective bargaining agreement, there is not going to be a requirement that you provide an attorney for someone who's not willing to pay for dues. You don't have to provide representation for them in their due process procedures. And it's going to be based on what's in the collective bargaining agreement to be negotiated. Most of them right now would require that representation, but in the future, I suspect they're not going to. So you're not going to be able to have, quote unquote, that insurance policy without paying the premium. So that's what we tried to do in the state budget.
Let me turn back to Ken Girardin, and then I'm going to let Carrie Andrews respond to some of what she's hearing. And I know she wants to respond to some of what Ken said in some of his opening remarks. Ken, what do you make of what you heard from the assemblyman there?
There are a few things. Number one, this case has nothing to do with collective bargaining. The state's collective bargaining law, as it was enacted in 1967, is unchanged. It's staying on the books. People will still have all the due process rights that they did before. I would point to the federal government, first and foremost, to the fact that federal government employees have been able to unionize since the 1960s. They've never been able to collect agency fees. And they're still, you know, they're as strong as ever. They have had to present the case to the workers of why they should support them, of why they present value. That's the thing that's absent from this entire conversation. And by the way, the scary thing with this situation is when you do get into organizations getting public money and engaging in political speech, you end up getting people in office, such as the governor, who want to act for those organizations' benefit to keep that money coming, and they're not acting in the individual workers' best interest, and they're also not acting in the taxpayers' interest. So, you know, the governor's been exemplifying this a lot with some of his rhetoric lately. But why aren't the unions themselves going and making the case to workers about why they should join? You know, we didn't have agency fees for the first 10 years in New York of collective bargaining. There's plenty of precedent here in New York, in the federal government, and even in right-to-work states, where they do have public sector unions there too, and they're able to function just as well as the ones in New York are. I don't understand why we would take the onus away from the union entirely and put it all on the state.
Carrie Andrews.
Yeah, well, Ken will be happy to hear that we're not bemoaning the decision in the case here, and we are actively and have been actively for a long time now talking to our members and making the case for why members should opt into and want to have a union. And fortunately, it's a pretty easy case to make. I did want to respond to a couple of other things that he said first. In terms of the concept of us unions representing everybody is something that we do embrace, in part because a union gets established with a democratic election. And so just like I personally didn't vote for the president of the United States, but he is the president, and so that was a democratic process we went through. He's now there. A union gets established the same way, and once it's established, it represents everybody in the bargaining unit. And so that's the process that allows us to represent everyone, and that's something that we fully embrace. And moving forward, we'll continue to embrace representing members and non-members. We are doing the work, and we have been doing the work, and we were prepared for this case to go speak to members one-on-one. And I really credit all the local leaders that are the local presidents of the 135 local affiliates of NYSA in the Rochester area, because they've been running campaigns for the past 3 years now, sitting down and talking with members one-on-one and talking about union value. talking about the benefits that a member receives from being in a union, talking about how opting in is the right thing to do and how we're all in this together, and the solidarity and the feeling of, yes, we don't like this decision, we think it's poorly reasoned and it was the wrong decision, but it's certainly not going to stop us in any way. All of us, I mean, have agreed to date that unions benefit the middle class, result in higher wages and better health care for the workers they represent. Unions are the pathway to the middle class, and our members know that and believe it and have been talking to each other about that for a long time. So, I mean, in NYSIT, I feel that the work we've done in Rochester has been the same that's gone on across the state with the hundreds of thousands of members who belong to NYSIT, and we feel very positive and strong about moving forward. It's a new day. It's a new law. It's a new framework to learn and to understand, but I'm very comfortable and confident saying that we're going to continue to be successful and negotiate collective bargaining agreements on behalf of our members.
Let me just follow up with Carrie Andrus, who is NYSIT Regional Staff Director. We'll take some of your phone calls. Our phone is already ringing. If you've got some emails to share with questions or comments about the Janus decision, how it applies in New York State and beyond, you can do that this hour. But Carrie, a couple things here. Clearly, you've been proactive because you said everybody sort of knew this was coming. Once Neil Gorsuch goes on the court, you know this is going to end up being a 5-4 decision. I think Harry's correct to point out that Alito himself has been sort of baking this cake leading up to this decision for years, and he even cited his previous decisions in the majority opinion for this case. So this is something Alito saw this 1977 case in Abood and said it's a problem and for years has been sort of teeing it up to try to take it down, and they were able to do that this week. So you've known this was coming. You're proactively reaching out to members and trying to convince them of the value of union membership. What do you expect the change will be? You know, what do you expect? And let's take it from a teacher's perspective, and then let's just take it to sort of public unions, and that no one has a crystal ball, but what do you think the actual impact on total overall membership is going to be?
Well, speaking for this region, we represent about 28,000 NYSIT members in the Rochester region, which is Monroe County and surrounding counties. And so on decision day, there were 379 who were non-members, who instantly became non-members. So that's roughly 1% of the membership who essentially is no longer a member of NYSIT on that day. And I think going forward, so that's a very small number, obviously, of the total population here. And I think the number's representative across the state as well. So moving forward, unions, the local unions that we work with, are putting together plans to continue the outreach to their members. And I truly believe that making the case for why it's in somebody's benefit to belong to a union is a pretty easy case to make, because the collective bargaining agreements that our local leaders work so hard to negotiate with the school districts at the table just provide benefits that are worth paying for. And so I don't think I'm naive in saying that I do truly believe that the vast majority of members will continue to belong to the union because they don't want to take the risk of losing their collective bargaining agreement.
The other part that I wanted to ask you about to make sure I understood, and I'll ask Carrie and Ken and Harry to help clear this up. Some of the analysis, whether it was Forbes, Vox.com, and others, focused at least in part on part of what Alito wrote in the majority opinion in Janus, saying that it appears now that it's going to be an opt-in situation as opposed to an opt-out. And I want at least a little clarity on this because I'm not an expert. And the way that I read that was, okay, so I'm now employed in the public sector, and the opt-out model would be you can now opt out in full. No agency fees, no partial fees. You can opt out in full if you choose to opt out, but otherwise you are opted in, versus a situation that says if you want union representation, you have to opt in and choose to pay the dues. Because if that's the case, the Vox.com analysis points to all kinds of other research on this kind of human behavior, and it's going to be a lot smaller membership if people have to choose to pay versus they can choose not to pay. Do you see, is there a distinction, and is that the case here, Carrie?
Well, how it usually operates in most of the places where we represent members is that when somebody is hired, they're asked to sign a membership form to join the union and to authorize dues deduction. And so that process will continue as it has for a long time. So at the beginning, then, if somebody chooses not to join, then they will be a non-member, and so they won't have anything deducted from their paycheck.
You don't seem to see much distinction between the two.
I think that may vary state by state.
Okay.
But how it's already operated in New York State, to me, it doesn't seem like a big difference.
Okay, Assemblyman Bronson, any difference?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate statement. One of the things we did in the budget when I talked about the procedural changes is we gave deadlines for which the employer has to provide the employee with notice of union representation. I think it's within 30 days. Within 30 days from that point, they have to provide the union with the contact information of the employee, name, address, job title, and the employee agency. And all of this is to facilitate the opt-in approach. And so I think that what we're trying to do is really give the employee the full decision on this. I think that, I mean, you had asked Carrie about what the impact may be, and I agree with Ken on this. You know, we can look at the federal government workforce where they did not have this requirement. And I think the postal workers locally, their union representation is 95% of the people paying dues and belonging to the union. So I think that, you know, there'll be a drop off. I don't know exactly what that drop off is, but I agree with Carrie. The real benefit here is that the labor movement is going to move from more of a transactional benefit idea to what it originally was founded on, and that is a brotherhood and a sisterhood that we're going to collectively fight for our workers' rights as well as other economic and social rights. So at the end of the day, I think in the long term, this is going to be beneficial for the labor movement.
All right. So let me get back to Ken Girardin, who's a policy analyst for the Empire Center for Public Policy. Ken, do you have an expectation on what this will do to overall union membership in the public sector in this country?
It's hard to say. I mean, looking at New York specifically, just because it's such a separate beast, the closest model that we've looked at was Michigan. When they abolished agency fees beginning in 2013, you saw about 1 in 5 teachers choose to leave the union. You saw a higher rate among non-teaching school district employees and local government employees. The lowest rate we saw was among, you know, I think corrections officers. They by and large stuck with their union, more or less. You know, you will overall see a drop. I mean, right now we're at, you know, the law has said 100% of people must pay. As soon as you don't have there, you are going to have some drop off. But you know, in upstate New York, which is a lot like Michigan by the numbers, I would expect us to see close to, you know, across the board, close to 1 in 5 people leave.
All right, and one more question for Ken before we turn it over to our listeners. We've got a lot of phone calls to work through and a lot of questions from our audience today. Ken, earlier this hour, the assemblyman said that we need to follow the money on who funded cases like this, and to him, the trail goes to the Koch brothers. Is that relevant to you? Does that matter to you that the Koch brothers have had a stake in this?
No. Reading the decision, it was, I would best describe it as housekeeping. I mean, it was a matter of cleaning up a bad ruling that past courts had erred away from. And by the way, even Justice Alito, he had 2 cracks at this case in previous instances where it would have been completely reasonable to scrap a boot. And that was in, you know, 2014 when agency fees were being charged of child care providers who weren't even state employees. And then previously in 2012 when agency fees got illegally hiked, to pay for some political costs. In both cases there, Alito could have gone for it. The fact that he waited 6 years to do it showed, you know, remarkable restraint and deference to stare decisis.
Why do you think there's so much money then on the effort of the pro-genocide, if it's just a speech case?
It's a speech case, but it's an important case. When you talk about government unions that have developed the ability to siphon money from the public fisc, which is what happens. I mean, it basically just bypasses the worker. They get a piece of the action. They're able to go and lobby the government. That's heavily influenced public policy. That's why we're such an outlier. That's why it costs more than $22,000 a year to educate a student in New York. That's why we have the highest tax burden in the country here. That's why, you know, and we'll take away the dollars and cents component. That's why we have so much inertia that you have to resist to change public policy here. I mean, and I'm speaking to people across the spectrum here. Anyone who's upset with a way that government operates, from people on the right who are upset about high taxes to people also on the right and on the left who want more accountability from police departments, that's all a function of government unions and the strength that they've been able to derive by changing the rules and, you know, pardon the term, but rigging the system.
All right,
so it makes, you know, it makes sense that there's going to be a lot of money towards fixing that.
I got to let Harry Bronson respond to that, the Assemblyman, and then we're going to get to your phone calls. Go ahead, Assemblyman.
Well, as an unapologetic labor movement supporter, I wish unions had the kind of power that Ken was just talking about. They really don't have that kind of power. They are they powerful? Absolutely. And do they speak for thousands of people? Absolutely. But the, you know, first of all, our Constitution, our New York State Constitution, gives workers the right to collectively bargain. And we did that in the 30s because of the economy that we were facing in the 30s. And, you know, we have to make sure that workers are not considered a commodity and that we pay them fair wages. And that unions help to do that. And I think Carrie mentioned this earlier. You know, the path through a union is a path to the middle class. And, yeah, we cannot continue to have a race to the bottom. And unfortunately, I think that's where the business community is coming from on this particular issue.
All right. So Ken thinks that there's a lot of good reasons for whether it's Cokes or anybody to want to fund a case like this, that the cost of government's too high, et cetera. Why did you invoke the Koch brothers? I mean,
I invoked the Koch brothers because they're fighting against workers' rights across the country. And they're you know, they're very wealthy individuals that are using their power because of that wealth to counter the ability of the majority of Americans to make ends meet and really get into the middle class. And, you know, whether you're talking about the Waltons, whether you're talking about the Koch brothers, the Mercers, that's their agenda. And it's an agenda that is an attack on the workers of this country. And so for them to pretend that they really care about freedom of speech in this, I just think is a red herring. And I think that this dissent's opinion was absolutely correct. This is an attack on workers.
Assemblyman, I see freedom of speech, but I also see cost of government. This is not the private sector. And I hear Ken and others who are maybe more on the side of Janice saying that this isn't just about workers getting better wages, better benefits. This is a higher cost to government that trickles down to us in many different ways.
And I'll give you one historical example. It was the unions in New York City that saved New York City from going bankrupt. Unions have made concessions over and over again. They've made concessions since I've been in office to reduce those costs. But at the same time, when the economy is churning along and there's ways to actually help individuals better their lot economically, we should be doing that. And in fact, one of the stats that wasn't talked about yet is the number of non-union workers who ultimately go on public assistance, which is a cost to government and a cost to taxpayers. And union workers typically are not in that situation.
And I just want to throw one thing in here. When we talk about unions, sometimes I think it's possible to think about a union and not realize the union is representing people who are taxpayers and who are residents of New York State, and they're representing families. So in the case of NYSIT, we're talking about all the teachers that you know. You're talking about the school bus drivers, cafeteria workers, custodians. Like these, it's not a separate entity. These are people who live in the state and who pay state taxes and who are part of our communities and who are going to work every single day doing really hard jobs, fighting for our students, fighting for better education outcomes, fighting for the future, really. And I just don't want that to get lost when we just use the word union, union, union to characterize who we're talking about.
That's Carrie Andrews, NYSIT Regional Staff Director, Harry Bronson, New York State Assemblyman, Ken Girard is a policy analyst for the Empire Center for Public Policy. I'll give you 30 seconds, Ken, then I got a break, and then it's all phone calls. Go ahead, Ken.
If we could, I'm sorry, I heard the Assemblyman talk about the concessions that unions made in New York City. I should mention that it was the demands the unions made that brought them to bankruptcy in the first place. But I don't want to take up time from the callers.
Okay, fair enough. Let's get that only break, and we're going to try to answer as many questions or comments as you can. If you're on the phone, hang there. We're going to move quickly after this break on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. Let's try to keep it tight on the phone. A lot of people want to weigh in, and I'm going to start with Michael. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. I'm a union carpenter, and I just basically wanted to give my comment, which is that ultimately, if the law is dictating that I have the right to reap the benefits of what the union gives me and not pay anything into the system that is protecting me and giving me all of these benefits for what honestly is a very nominal cost of member dues, that I personally am not going to stop paying dues. I think that in order to keep the unions alive, that it's the union members' responsibility to keep that system perpetuating by paying their fair share. As far as the comment about the Koch brothers and you know, the attack on workers, I completely agree that it's easy for, you know, people who are not out there sweating on 100-degree days doing hard labor to say, well, you know, the taxes are crazy. We need to make sure that we can cut spending somewhere without looking at career politicians or bureaucrats who are doing jobs all over the state making far more than they should be making for something that's really not a necessity of the system. Without unions, without carpenters, without teachers, without police officers, the whole state will be completely unpalatable. No one will want to live here anyway. So whether we pay dues or not is not going to change the fact that that's a necessity. I mean, it'll be easy to get low-cost labor, low-skilled labor that'll also reflect that, you know, within 5-10 years of, let's say you get an unskilled carpenter to build a structure, that will show. So if you're saving costs now on not paying workers as much as, honestly, they should be making more than they are, then you're going to spend that money later in re-educating students that weren't educated properly, dealing with police officers who weren't trained properly, dealing with buildings that were built by masons and carpenters that weren't built properly.
Yeah,
I just think that...
Michael, let me just jump in because we got a lot of folks, and I appreciate you taking the time to call. And I want to direct this over to Ken Girardin because what Michael is saying there is, let's take a look at his point about sort of low skilled or low wage and unskilled labor there. Ken Girardin, do you agree that with this decision, workers are probably going to make less?
I wouldn't. I don't see anything after this ruling that results in people's pay going down or benefits going down. I think the unions will have less money to play politics with afterwards. They will have to more narrowly tailor their political agendas so that they don't risk alienating people. But I don't think there's a single elected official who saw this ruling come down and started, you know, taking zeros out from employee benefits.
Carrie Andrews?
Sure. I do want to acknowledge Michael. Thanks for his feedback, too, and his work as a union carpenter. That's great to hear. But I want to clear up this one point that Ken's made before also about unions and politics and campaign contributions. Just to be clear, because this gets misunderstood a lot, at least for NYSED and I believe the case for other public sector unions in New York State, our dues don't go to fund political activity. Political activity is entirely separate from the dues that are deducted from a worker's paycheck. Anything that goes towards politics is a voluntary contribution that a member makes on top of their dues. So it's entirely separate. We don't combine those funds, and just want to be clear there that union dues do not go to support to do candidate endorsements or contributions.
Carrie, that's not correct. NYSET is part of the Working Families Party. How does NYSET pay its dues to the Working Families Party, which go towards political campaigns? Does it come out of VoteCoop or does it come out of your general fund dues?
Well, we'd have to take a look through the whole NYSET budget, but generally speaking, campaign contributions to candidates do not come out of dues. And it's something we talk a lot about with members, just the distinction that is made to make it clear that if there's a contribution that's going to support a political candidate, then it's coming out of a voluntary contribution on top of dues.
Voluntary.
Correct. Voluntary. There's no assessed fee or anything that goes towards dues.
It's
a political action fund.
Do your workers have questions about this routinely?
I think it's unclear sometimes, and so we do spend time, and we have VoteCoop coordinators in our area who meet with members as well, and we put out this information out just so it is clear that your dues do not go towards political activity.
Part of why the Supreme Court case in Janus, I mean, the guy's name was Mark Janus, and he didn't really believe this. His concern was, you know, my dues go to support an organization that's making political speech that mm-hmm. I don't agree with, and he couldn't separate it. You're saying it can be separated.
Yes, I'm saying that it is currently separated.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, if I may, Evan, I mean, his exact argument was that because when the union collectively bargains, it's asking for higher salaries and wages for its workers and higher benefits, that in turn results in higher taxes, and because he opposes higher taxes, that was the speech that was being violated. So it, you know, he made a unique argument, whereas in Abboud that was not the case. They were talking more specifically about political speech and lobbying itself.
Well, and here's an email from a listener named Dave who says, it seems to me that the Janus decision pretty much demands, if we're being logical, that no one should be compelled to pay taxes at all. The underlying logic seems very similar to me and equally untenable for a functioning society with some semblance of equality. The court, of course, would never make that decision. They are attempting to eviscerate unions, plain and simple. So, Ken, Dave is saying, play this out here. You don't like how your money is being compelled to be collected from you is spent. Well, my tax dollars go to government. I don't like what government's doing with my tax dollars. Can't the court say, can't we take it out that far?
There are two very big differences. There's a very big difference, for starters, between the power of the state and the power that the state can delegate to a third party. What the state was doing here was delegating its confiscatory power to an outside organization, which should never happen. I mean, just on good government and due process grounds. So those are two completely separate issues. But I want to come back to the question about how union money was being spent on politics. And to be clear, yes, NYSIT supports political causes through general fund dues. Despite what they say about their voluntary contributions, anyone can go and look at their federal filings at unionreports.gov that are made to the Department of Labor every year, and they can see the political spending that NYSIT does out of dues. So I wanted to set that straight, number one. Number two, you're hitting on an important point that was an issue before Janus, where the unions were routinely using money from fee payers and telling people, oh no, these are just the funds that we spent on representational costs. The NYSIT affiliate in New York City that represents CUNY professors got caught red-handed covering up, hiding their political costs and billing them out as office supplies and telling members that, oh no, no, we only spent this limited amount of money on politics, when in fact the figure was about 10 times higher. So it was a really untenable system that Mark Janus was complaining about.
Okay. Carrie Andrews, go ahead.
Yeah, we have a very thorough and vetted process where our expenses get audited each year, and there's a determination made about what's chargeable versus non-chargeable for an agency fee payer. So I would just disagree with what Ken's put out there.
Yeah, and Ken, I don't fully understand where to draw the example you're giving. Well, one case somewhere, someone was misusing funds, so we changed the entire system. I take the point. You don't want to see anybody misuse funds anywhere, especially for political speech. But there's misuse of funds everywhere.
It was the point that you can't draw a line between what is and isn't political, because when you try to, people will inevitably try to tuck money on the wrong side of that line.
I got to get back to your phone calls, and I want to kind of keep it moving here, because unfortunately we're not doing 2 hours on this. We're just doing one. Scott in Prattsburg next. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Evan. I love your show, and I think I can do it in
10 Well, you're very kind. Thank you.
Don't laugh too hard. We're blowing time here. But let's look at this from a different lens. What do you say we go right down the middle with transparency, both sides, and take a look? And, you know, neither one of the union organizations are on your show right now, but I know of one. They got back from Hawaii for their convention, and my dues got jacked significantly, and the following year they went to Rutherford, New Jersey. And when you look at things like that, elected officials where you might see the past union vice president passing out write-in votes and sort of soliciting there a little bit, I can see where somebody might not want to join the union. I can see real benefits. I can see benefits with a master agreement. I can see how that could really work for somebody. But if they fail to represent, that leaves that person to do it. And it really gives a bad taste. You know what? Word gets out. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Scott. Some thoughts from our guest, Carrie Andrews?
Yeah, I think that kind of goes back to what we were talking about a little bit before, that unions are democratic institutions. If a union's not operating well in a way that membership is pleased with, then another election will roll around, usually in a year or two, and there'll be an opportunity for other members to get involved and to run for leadership. So, and same with union budgets. Most of our local affiliates put their union budgets up for discussion, so we do certainly encourage transparency. And there's a process in place to make changes.
Harry Bronson.
And there's also an opportunity if a union member is feeling they're not being represented by their union, they can bring a claim both in the private sector and in the public sector to say that they're not being fairly represented.
And Ken Girardin?
people deserve the right to choose, and they can collect the facts and make the choice that works best for them and their family.
Back to the phone calls we go. We got to keep it tight here. Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, good afternoon. First of all, if Mr. Janus is an ethical person that he probably thinks he is, then he should refuse to accept any raises or benefits that are negotiated on his behalf by the union. If he's not willing to pay for it, he's being a freeloader, and he has no right to collect any raises or benefits. Secondly, I'd like to ask your guest, Mr. Jardin, does he really think that I have individual power to go into my boss's office, or if I get called into my boss's office and accused of something, they have their bosses all lined up with them? If I don't have my shop steward or a union backing me up, does he really think I have the same power that those bosses have?
Ken?
I think you have the right to choose. If you feel that that's the best course of action for you, then
do I have that power without a union? Do I have that power without a union? Is it an equal?
I don't know. Are you an exceptionally good employee? Are you an exceptionally good employee? Is there value to keeping you? No, I mean, tell me. Is there? What are they weighing when they bring you in? The reason you don't have the ability to negotiate yourself is because the union took it away from you.
No, it is not.
Start with that.
No, it is not.
Yes, it is.
You do not have a union. You do not have an equal power to the bosses.
Go ahead, Ken.
By the way, we're talking just about the public sector here. We're not talking about the private sector. We're not talking about the trades.
True.
We're talking about the elected bosses. So you have the ability to influence who your elected boss is. And that's the whole reason why you can't just carbon copy collective bargaining from the private sector into the public sector.
Well, we're talking about public sector unions, but you're saying all elected bosses, Ken?
I'm saying in the public sector, you're dealing with elected bosses or bosses who are accountable to elected officials.
There's a
different mechanism of accountability.
I guess I can almost see that, I guess, perhaps. But, I mean, they're still appointed superintendents or heads of state agencies. I don't know.
But that doesn't really answer the question. I think the premise of Ken's answer was that employer decisions are only based on how they value the employee, and that's just not how it happens in real life. I mean, there are times when an employee gets called in because they're not doing something right or something of that nature. But the whole difference here, when you have collective bargaining, there's due process rights that go along with that. And the employer has to show that you have done something wrong in order for there to be an adverse employment action. And for you to, for anybody to believe that every individual employee, with or without that kind of value, is going to be on a level bargaining playing field with the employer, I just don't think that's based in reality.
Well, that's how it works when you work in the state assembly. So, assemblymen, are you saying that you're committing some kind of transgression against your workers by not having them unionize?
I would be happy if from my position, it's not my choice, but I have no problem with my staff person sitting next to me if he wanted to unionize. I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Let me just get a quick email from Tim, who says, can you explain why members who don't pay their union dues going forward will still be considered members and receive the same benefits from the union anyway? Legally, Assemblyman Bronson, Tim just wants to know, why does the law now say you don't have to pay your dues and there can't be any agency fees, but you still have to be repped in negotiations? Tim's saying, why not? Why not just say, look, you didn't pay your dues. You're separate from this. You're on your own.
I think number one, it doesn't apply to the collective bargaining concept, so that's a problem. But what we did in the budget was to limit that representation to some degree under the duty of fair representation in the Taylor Act. So we didn't go 100% where Tim is saying, but we have gone a step in that direction.
Right. So the scenario on how it works for us is once a union's voted in, whether it was in 1969 or 1990 or whenever it was formed, that union then has the obligation to represent everybody who's a title in its recognition clause in the contract. So if it's a union representing all teachers in a given school district, then every single teacher now, whether they want to become a member or be a non-member, is still recognized or represented by the association.
20 seconds. What's your message now for public union members who are trying to understand this case going forward?
going forward, it's a new day, but I would say to work with your colleagues, and that we are stronger together when we stand together, and when we try to, when we negotiate collective bargaining agreements together, and we have everybody who's belonging to the collective group. And so we'll continue to provide great representation and negotiate great contracts with you.
Ken, for those who have wanted to see the union movement brought down, is this, 20 seconds to you, is this a step in that direction, and is this a victory for that movement?
I wouldn't count myself as someone who wants to see unions brought down. It does level the playing field in a lot of regards between management and unions, and that's good news for taxpayers.
Ken Girardin is a policy analyst for the Empire Center for Public Policy. You can find them online. Been writing a lot about these issues and others, and we appreciate the time this afternoon. Ken, thanks for coming on the program.
No, thanks, and thanks to the other guests.
You got it. Assemblyman Harry Brunson is pretty accessible himself, and I know he'll have a lot to say on this going forward. It's just about 24 hours old, this case, but thanks for coming in and explaining more on the state's position, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Evan.
And Carrie Andrews and NYSET's Regional Staff Director, they're already doing a lot of work on this and more, and I know that will continue. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Short break, more connections coming up.